This is Triad Arts Weekend. Joseph Mills has a new book of poems due out on Press 53 next week. It's called This Miraculous Turning, and in it, he shares stories at points hilarious and sublime about, among other things, race in America, as experienced in his biracial family. Joe and his wife, who are both white, are raising their two African-American children in Winston-Salem. This Miraculous Turning is one of those books you're going to want to share, but you may just hesitate, because you know you're going to want to return to it again and again yourself. Take it from the laureates. Former North Carolina poet laureate Joseph Bethanty describes Joe's poems as conversational, profound, narrative, and leavened with inimitable humor, often wry, often wistful. He continues, but these are also tough poems, thrumming with a quintessential helplessness that is so quintessentially human. Former Virginia poet laureate Kelly Cherry writes, everything here is true, measured, faultless. You do not want to miss this book. This miraculous turning is a bona fide miracle. Not bad, Joe. The UNC School of the Arts Susan Burris Wall Distinguished Professor dropped by to chat about it.
I've written about my family before in my previous collection, Love and Other Collisions. I talked about my family and I've written about them. And you could read those poems and never know my family's transracial, that my wife and I are white-looking, and my kids are black. And partly because I didn't feel, first, that I wanted to deal with those issues in those particular poems, and second, I wasn't sure that I was good enough as an artist yet to kind of deal with those issues. Because these are not, in dealing with race or adoption, I'm not making statements. I don't have something that I want to say. I'm saying these are my experiences, and we're kind of exploring, I guess, what they mean, you know, kind of the things that they encapsulate. So I'm not standing up there and saying, I have something to say about race, or I have something to say. I am standing up there and saying, I have something to say about my family and the experiences my family has.
Brandon really was one of the first that made me kind of shift gears with regard to reading Joe Mills poetry. Like this seems like a new direction in a sense. Great poem.
Thank you. As I walk with my daughter, you know, there's a wonderful part in the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer where the parent says how odd it is to be raising a child that you know is much smarter than you are. And I had that experience very early on with my daughter. She's always asking questions. And one of the questions she asked was, you know, Daddy, what was there before there was anything at all? And, you know, I thought I could answer that. I thought, you know, there's trees and there's meadows. And she's like, no, before there was anything, what was there? And it was this moment that I realized, oh, you are working out these issues in a way that I never did until I was much older. So she's constantly asking questions. And this is one of the questions and conversations that my daughter and I have had. This is a poem called Branded. On the way to the grocery, my daughter asks, Daddy, does it hurt to be branded? Since we had been talking about lemonade and whether the pink kind tastes different than the yellow, the question surprises me. Of course, I say. And she wants to know how I know and how it's done and why someone would do it to someone else. She's been reading the novel Chains, whose heroine gets branded on the cheek. So as we pass Borders, Pier 1 Imports, and World Market, we talk about scars, hot metal, the small crescent burned into her calf by a car's exhaust pipe. We talk about how branding compares with tattooing, why people would do either, and the difference between being forced and choosing to do something. We talk about what you carry on your body for life, and what kind of a tattoo we would get, whether we'd have a word or an image. We talk about how words from a story or a book or a classmate can sear and disfigure. We talk about if what you get on your body is different than what you get on your tombstone. She asks what can be written on bones. And we talk about archaeology and graves. And then suddenly she says she thinks pink probably doesn't taste different, but the eye makes you think that it does.
And in addition to capturing just how serious intent and thoughtful young people, in this case your daughter, can be, you also capture that ability that I've always admired in childhood behavior, where you go from completely engrossed in something really serious, and then in a blink of an eye, you go to the light stuff as if it never happened.
Yeah, and that constant shifting back and forth as you're thinking of them, if not simultaneously, just one after the other after the other, and always be ready for, you never know what question's going to come next.
Well, your daughter comes back with another great insight with, my daughter continues to be annoyed by George Washington.
Yeah, this is a couple of observations she made on George Washington that over time, and then I kind of put them together in a poem. This is called My Daughter Continues to be Annoyed by George Washington. A plaque on the Salem Tavern says, George Washington slept here. It's true. It's well documented. And it doesn't impress my daughter. She's not a fan. She hasn't been since she was 6 and learned how Washington freed his slaves on his deathbed. He waited, she said, until he didn't need them. And they were probably too old to enjoy their freedom then. Later, looking at her allowance, she insisted, George Washington shouldn't even be on the dollar. When I offered to keep the money, I saw the struggle, the realization this wasn't how it should be, but how it is. The symbols are the ones we live with. No, she said, I'll take it, sensing as she did so that she had been forced to participate in something under the guise of choice. Now, at the Salem Tavern, where the first president walked, she reads the sign out loud, George Washington slept here. And she asks, where did his slaves sleep?
Wow, that's a very adult observation that many of us wouldn't make. But how do you process that?
And how do we process it? And how do we explain it to our children? How much do we protect them? How much do we explain to them? I'm constantly trying to evaluate what stories do they need to make them strong. And I don't want to hide things from them, but there are certainly some things that they don't need to know right now. And growing up near Old Salem and growing up in the South, we come into this life with all of this history and legacy behind us. And so partly what I explore in some of these poems are some really odd moments. I don't actually have a poem about this. I tried and tried and it never worked. But my daughter had a karaoke machine and she's singing. And one time I realize she's singing Dixie. And I just kind of hope she'll stop so I won't have to deal with it. And then, but she's trying to sing it again and she hasn't heard it. She's trying to work out Dixie. And so I'm there and I'm standing at the bottom of the steps and I'm thinking, okay, my black daughter is up there singing Dixie. What do I do about this? And, we've talked about the Civil War and we've talked about slavery, but it was just a really odd moment. And sometimes as a parent, you're just not quite sure how to deal with it.
Yeah. I grew up just with certain things in mind that were rock solid. George Washington, good.
Yeah.
Abe Lincoln, good. And then nobody's perfect. He had slaves, gave them up on his deathbed, as your daughter pointed out. So then do you change it and affect what comes later at such a young age, or do you keep the myth going?
When my family and I travel, I grew up in, like you say, I grew up in Indiana in the North, and my brother and I many times would visit Gettysburg. And the narrative of Gettysburg to us was very straightforward. We had this battle and we were fighting for the Union and we made America America, and that's what the Hoosiers did. And I have a long poem in the book about it where my family goes. And so my kids, I've always looked for the Indiana memorials. And so we're there this time and my kids are saying, where are the North Carolina monuments? And I have no idea. And literally I realize, they're over there on the other side of the battlefield where I have never gone. Because I'm a Northerner and I'm a Northerner raising born and bred Southerners. So we go over to look at them. And it's like, this is the southern side. And then my son asks, well, Daddy, where would I be? And I'm not just raising a Southerner, I'm raising a African-American Southerner. And that's a very complicated story. So what do I tell him? And what kind of stories do we kind of talk about? And where would you be? And so as you're raising your children, you constantly are rethinking kind of history and what it means. And, he has this really wonderful moment as we're standing there at the battlefield and he's young and where Pickett's Charge happens and this kind of, I think it's Shelby Foote who calls it it's Faulkner who says it's the high point of the South. And he's looking at the field and he's processing. They cross that huge field into guns and he's like, Daddy, that would just be stupid. It's like there is no mythology there for him. It's like you would walk across that field into cannons and guns. That's a terrible idea. So So this is the poem that concludes the middle section, and it's called Here. Where are you from? My children are asked. Not because of how they talk or how they look, but how we look with one another. This unfamiliar form of family we have put together. And when they answer, here, North Carolina, the South, they're not believed. Africa, a classmate says, your parents adopted you from there. No, my daughter explains, I was born in Charlotte. The girl continues to insist, no, somewhere in Africa. My daughter comes home, where she's lived all her life, where she recognizes everyone on both sides of the street, where she intimately knows each tree in a 3-block radius, and she recounts the discussion. We all agree it's puzzling and wonder how to respond. We ask if there's something she wants us to do, perhaps talk to the teachers or parents. Yes, she says, there is something. Maybe, before dinner, we could put on some music and dance together, here, in our house, our family, such as it is, such as we are.
That image is just priceless. Do you remember when that came to you, that resolution?
No, I don't. I'm happy with it. Maybe happier than I should be. I'm really very pleased with these poems. I think these are some of the best work that I've done. Hopefully it's not the best work I'll ever do, but it's the best work I've done so far. And that resolution, you know, in my family, we talk about race, but we don't think about being a transracial family until we go out the door and we see how other people are responding to us. And then it constantly strikes us afresh. And so there's the family that we have within the house and the family that we have outside of the house. So I just really love the idea of our own family here.
I love the way she embraces that too. I mean, that's just a powerful expression of, I mean, she recognizes the two worlds herself, and in her own vernacular, this is the way to solidify what she knows and draw strength from. I just think it's so beautiful.
One of the things that strikes me there too, in that particular incident, and one of the things that annoyed my daughter was, here was somebody trying to take away her southernness, that you're not really a southerner, you're not really from here, and they're born and bred here. They identify as southerners.
Poet and UNC School of the Arts Susan Burris Wall Distinguished Professor Joseph Mills. The launch party for Joe's new book of poems, This Miraculous Turning, is Thursday, October 2nd at Artworks Gallery on Trade Street. Joe will be at Scuppernong Books on October 11th, and he'll join a panel at the Winston-Salem New Museum on November 18th. What Does It Mean to Be Southern? With authors Cheryl Harry and Ed Southern. This Miraculous Turning is published by Press 53, and you'll find links to more of their offerings and Joe's complete calendar at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and after this teeny little break, we're going to find out what all the hubbub is about Steinway pianos. Salem College's Barbara Listersink has an inkling. The Steinway artist has been tickling their ivories for decades, and she's working to keep the Steinway legacy alive and well at Salem next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We're going to learn some manners with Paper Lantern Theater and their production of Mrs. Mannerly later on in the show. And we'll also learn about creative writing during The Right Motivation. A sneak preview is on the way. But first, it's an homage to the king of the concert stage, piano. Generations of Salem College students, teachers, and audiences have enjoyed life-changing experiences, compliments of the school's 17 Steinway pianos and the soloists who've performed on them. Each Steinway comes with more than 10,000 working parts, but after decades of use, the school's cherished instruments, from Margaret Mueller's 1918 Steinway B to Dean Sandreski's 1938 Concert Grand, are now in urgent need of help. The Sandreski-Listersink Steinway Piano Restoration Project comes to the rescue beginning this weekend with dazzling Ukrainian-American pianist Marina Lamazov and Salem's artist-in-residence Barbara Listersink live in concert. Barbara's been a Steinway artist since 1978. Salem College is home to several Steinways, and maybe you could break down for listeners how they hold up over time or not.
We have 17 of them, and we call them vintage Steinways, although I think the youngest we have is 1987, which was given by an anonymous donor to have a concert grand, a concert Steinway in Haynes Auditorium. They're the big auditorium. So that really is the youngest, the little baby. And we've had several donated to us, but they're older. I think the oldest we have, maybe the Margaret Mueller B, the Steinway B, beautiful instrument.
1918,
and its serial number is very significant. It's 19,000. And then my personal favorite is the Shirley Concert Grand, which I don't think there's anything any more beautiful except maybe my own Homburg Steinway at home, but this is an extraordinarily beautiful instrument. In Shirley Hall that other people love too, but it is 1938.
Yeah.
So these are in sore need. They remind me of sort of lovely, I used to have a huge collection of aunts who would sit on front porches and in their older years, you know, and just sort of rock after Sunday dinner, but they'd just sit there and they would seem to be sort of inert and not saying much, but then if you spoke with them or you sat down and you actually talked with them, they came alive. And so I think it's the neglect that I felt personally pretty bad for. We've done our best with maintenance and tuning and all of that, but as Horowitz mentioned in this wonderful quote, there are about 11,000 working parts. I love what Horowitz said, pianos need constant care and don't often receive it. At least every month or two, they should be tuned and voiced. If this isn't done within a year's time, the piano will run down like a human being who neglects his health. A piano has some 11,000 working parts, and if one of those goes awry, then the piano doesn't function right. A piano is very vulnerable, unquote.
Wow.
Well, so Horowitz wrote that in one of his bio.
Barbara, how do you respond to the piano naysayer that would throw out, I'm not among them, but would just say, okay, you've got your Busendurfers, your Baldwins, your Yamahas. What's the big difference? What makes Steinway so great?
The craftsmanship, which makes this individuality, and the very care that goes into each instrument does make it more unique, each one. Now, they're not all created equal, and that's why when people go up to New York or Long Island or wherever, or a dealership, to try them out, then they have to really play a number of instruments, and they very quickly see that they're radically, radically different, each one. But I have to mention the importance of the piano technician, because a good piano technician, not to mention a superb piano technician, like we have a number of them here in this area. John Foy, for instance, works now out of Greensboro and Chapel Hill, but John was our technician for a long time at Salem. And then Bill Huseman is at School of the Arts. John Chapman, of course, works at Salem and Wake, and Sheila Hunter. We have, I call them the piano boys. Sheila's an honorary piano boy. And they are magnificent, and they know exactly what they're doing. And as John Foy one time said, he can take most any Steinway, and together with a pianist, if I have my own unique sense of tone production and quality, which I do, and my own druthers, my own preferences about touch, which I very much do, and which is a very complicated issue, touch, and all of that goes into key control to make a beautiful musical performance. But if I talk with him about that at great length, which we have over the years, he can pretty much tailor that. Each piano can be tailored to the owner's preferences more than most people might think. It's not cheap, nor should it be, but it really can be done, you know.
I've heard stories of Gary Graffman and Leon Fleischer and great pianists. They would trade off uses of specific pianos. Like they would, okay, you're traveling there this week, you get the piano, and then next week, and they would trade it off. So I'm curious if you could describe, Barbara, some of the nuances of that sort of relationship with your instrument in terms of how playing on this Steinway, your Steinway, impacts your music making. What does it give you? What in terms of expression, anything? I just want to give listeners a sense of why it's so precious.
Well, I'm sure all of your listeners have come upon a person. You can be on a bus, or you can be on a plane, or you can be just in the grocery store, checkout line, at food line, and you sort of look at each other and you start up a conversation and you realize that you have an enormous amount in common, and there's this richness that just elevates you about the conversation and makes you feel like life is much better and much grander and much sweeter. And that's what I feel when I sit down to a really beautiful instrument. I'll give you a story, a quick story. It was in the late 80s when I'd come down to Salem as dean and professor of piano. And I had this Feurig, and I'd already paid good money for it. But I wanted a Homburg Steinway, desperately. But they were very expensive. They had taken a turn a little bit lower economically, so they weren't that expensive, but I couldn't find a good one. So I gave it up in the 80s. I just gave up the idea. And so I went up to Steinway's in New York on 57th Street to find a piano for a cousin of mine, actually, who was buying pianos for his college. And my sales rep, Dave White, who's now deceased, but a wonderful sales rep and a great jazz musician, too. Dave said, oh, by the way, don't forget to look in the Rachmaninoff room. That we have a couple of Homburg Steinways in there, 7-foot, B's, they're called. And I know you've always been interested in finding one. I said, well, I'm certainly not in the market right now. I don't have any money for it, and I've got this Feurig, so whatever. So I tried out a bunch of pianos. It was a very bleak, cold New York, rainy March day. I was tired. It was 3 o'clock, 3:30, and I was really hungry and wanted to go out for lunch, and I'd kind of had it with trying out all these pianos. It gets a little old after a while, especially if you don't meet that person, that the one, you might say, which you keep looking for. And so I was walking down that beautiful hall with all those portraits of Rubinstein and Rachmaninoff and all this, that grand old place, and I out of the corner of my eye in the Rachmaninoff room, I saw these two black, they're like patent leather shoes. That back then, now American Steinways are patent leather, kind of. They're very glossy, high gloss. But back then, you could identify in the late 80s a Homburg Steinway by its high gloss. And so I saw them. So I went over to the corner and I tried one. I thought, oh, this is lovely. It reminded me of all my days in Holland and playing on Homburg Steinways, which I love. But it was lovely. It was beautiful. I thought, oh, well, whatever. And so I had my coat on. I had my bag on. It was cold. It was raining. Ready to go. But then I saw another one out of the corner of my right eye. I thought, oh, he said there were two. Okay, I'll sit down. I sat down, David, and played one chord. I immediately started weeping. Now, I'm not exaggerating. And I played another chord. And an hour later, with my raincoat still on and my handbag still on my left shoulder, I got up with tears on my face. I'm not exaggerating at all. I walked over to Dave and I said, I don't care how much this is, I have to have it. It's the most beautiful instrument I've ever played. I'm fallen in love. And he said, okay. And now, the happy ending is that that very piano now would be about $150,000 to $170,000. And even back then, had it been on a retail list, it would have been more, but it was a nearly new sale. It was still brand spank new. It had been waiting for me for about 4 years in Ohio on some showroom floor, and nobody had wanted it. I couldn't understand this, but it's because you're so personally attached to the particular instrument. And it turned out to be something like $26,000, which is a lot of money, but for a Homburg Steinway of that size, that goes beyond a steal. So I bought it and have never been happier, and it sits in my house, sometimes too neglected, but it's my oldest and best friend, you might say, you know. So that's why, you know, I can remember pianos in South Dakota, one particular, in Marshall University in West Virginia. I just remember these incredible personalities, like you remember these great personalities like Frank Glaser, you know, and these various people. You remember them. You think of them. And if you meet somebody, I just met someone from Marshall not long ago, and I just said, oh, I've never, that was one of the most glorious instruments I've ever played on. This was years ago. So that's my piano story.
That's a great one. So, Barbara, in terms of the instruments on the Salem campus now, there's 17 Steinways. How does the price fluctuate over the years? And some of them have been there for...
They've been there almost over 100 years.
Wow.
It has increased almost tenfold. Your average concert grand now, a concert grand, by the way, it's 9 feet long. So it has the biggest power punch. It costs now around $140,000, $150,000. institutions get a bit of a price break, but retail, it's over $150,000. And back in 1975, it was around $13,500, about $14,000. So we're talking tenfold.
So now we know why, for those who say, well, why don't you just buy some new pianos? That ain't going to happen. But the renovation possibilities are pretty profound because, as you mentioned, with a good technician, and in this case, $500,000 is the goal, you can do amazing things.
You can do amazing things, and not every piano over there needs a complete renovation. A total renovation, by the way, means really a new soundboard, which is the heart and soul of the instrument, and a new pen block, which is what the strings all wrap around, and a number of things like that, or casework, all of that. But most of our pianos, actually, all of them need varying degrees of restoration. Some of them need a complete overhaul, like the 1918 Margaret Mueller, that splendid, splendid piano. But it's going to need a total remake, and so that gets pretty pricey.
Well, one great way to put a focus on the need and the value of great instruments at Salem is through the music. I can't think of a better way. And Legacy Alive is the concert performance Friday, September 26th. You've invited Russian pianist Marina Lomazov, and yourself will be performing. I want to jump into the program a little bit on this. Well, it's a wonderful evening of music, especially if you like Rachmaninoff, whom I certainly do. And you get to play a little, is it going to be a piano for four hands, two pianos?
Piano? Yes, two Steinways, in fact, two Steinway concert grands on the Haynes stage. Yeah, the big Ds, we call them there, the 9 foot.
I was listening to that Suite number 2 by Sergei Rachmaninoff for two pianos and thinking, boy, he didn't pull any punches with this. I mean, it's almost like one of the concertos coming at you.
It is. It's a wonderful, wonderful. I love that piece. And the reason that I chose to sort of set up this Legacy Alive is that not only do pianos have legacies, but great pianists, there's a legacy that we all sort of follow in our own pedigree. I go back to a lot of Russian school training, the old Russian school. And I think the Steinway itself, its apogee, in a way, was 1890s, 1900, and not many changes have been made ever since. So there was a time of what many people call the golden age of piano playing, when a lot of these great players, and a lot of them were Russian, some of them were people like my teacher Guido Agosti in Italy and his teacher Busoni, but they somehow, this era spawned some of the greatest pianists of all time. And a lot of the great piano music was written in that era, because technique also, which I teach, you know, injury preventive technique, I try to teach this kind of technique that produces a really beautiful tone, all sorts of tones, but a really free, rich, resonant tone. So, and also a kind of technique that allows people to play things like the Rachmaninoff Second Suite with ease and without accumulation of tension or injury. So it felt natural to emphasize this grand old tradition and these composers who wrote for the piano at its apogee, which would also include Rachmaninoff, but also Ravel and Debussy and Scriabin. There's so many great composers like that for the piano that people love because they also were great pianists and they could play their own music because they had a certain type of technique that allowed for them to play this glorious music that sort of ran all over the keyboard, cascading like waterfalls everywhere, you know. And the Rachmaninoff's like that. It's fast, it's light, it's delicate, it's powerful. It has everything, not to mention it has incredible heart, which everyone knows,
sure.
You know. So Rachmaninoff in his own life was spurned in some ways by some of the critics who didn't think he was, you know, he wasn't the Viennese school, you might say.
Too romantic.
Actually, too beautiful.
Yeah.
Too beautiful to be believed, you know. Too popular. Too accessible. Well, actually, you know, I think Bach's pretty accessible to a lot of people. And the point is, it's, as we say now in academia, it's not either or, it's both and. I think you can be both accessible and gorgeous and also deep and profound. So I think that's why I chose to emphasize this, because of the tone involved, the technique involved, the touch, and the beauty.
Salem College artist-in-residence and longtime Steinway artist Barbara Listersink. On Friday, September 26th at 7:30 in Haynes Auditorium on the Salem campus, she'll team up with acclaimed Ukrainian-American pianist Marina Lamazov in a concert of Russian and American music. The gala concert and reception will launch the Sandresky Listersink Steinway Piano Restoration Project, and you'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We'll take a short break and come back with an insider's look at the ins and outs of creative writing. Do you know about the different modes of writing? If not, no worries, because associate producer Bethany Chafin is all over it like white on rice. She's here with established authors Chris Laney and Steve Cushman with more. Then it's time to sit up straight, look me in the eye, and say, pleased to meet you. Paper Lantern Theater Company and Mrs. Mannerly have their eyes on you next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. Paper Lantern Theater Company is in the house and ready with a hilarious dramatic read from Mrs. Mannerly that's just about 10 minutes away. Next up, Bethany Chafin takes us behind the scenes into the wide world of literature.
Chris Laney and Steve Cushman are established writers. Steve has written two novels, Portisville and Heart with Joy. His short story collection is titled Fracture City, and his debut poetry chapbook titled Hospital Work came out this year. And Chris is the writer behind the blog Lessons from the Cockpit, Everyday Wisdom from the Flying Life. He's also written for numerous magazines and websites such as Our State, American Venture, and NC Tourism. Now, Chris and Steve are collaborating to co-teach The Right Motivation. That's W-R-I-T-E, a 6-week creative writing class ideal for both beginning and advanced writers. Chris and Steve joined me to discuss the course and their own writing experiences. Steve spoke first.
Our goal isn't so much, I don't think, for a specific genre. I mean, as far as the blogs versus the magazines, the goal is just for us in the workshop to get the participants writing, and to get them writing sort of past that first draft. And one of the things is trying to get them to understand sort of the difference between first draft writing work and editing, you know, sort of taking that first draft, that sort of boulder, and molding it into something. And so that's a big piece of the class, is sort of giving them those techniques, those tips to actually take their writing perhaps to the next level and sort of stay interested in the writing and to stay motivated as time passes on with the writing.
And partially by just giving them competence, you know, the competence to write. That's what holds a lot of people back. You know, it's just lack of competence. And, it really is a process, and you have to keep doing it. But, I mean, what Steve said about that's one of the things that we talk about in the class. I mean, I believe there's two modes of writing. And to be successful, you know, a writer needs to grasp those two different modes. And for me, you know, there's that creative mode, which is stream of consciousness. Let me get the idea out. You don't worry about typos. You don't worry about grammar. You don't worry about sentence structure. You get the thing out. I like to call it you're creating your block of stone that you'll chisel later, right? So, and then there's that editing mode. And in the creative mode is right brain. The editing mode is left brain. So you're switching over to the logical, the analytical, and refining your sentences, fixing the grammar, fixing the typos. And I think one of the main problems I see in a lot of beginning or emerging writers is that they will switch between those two modes in one writing session. So they'll sit down and they'll start in a creative mode and they've got something good going on, but they'll get two or three paragraphs into it and they'll switch to editing mode and they'll start playing with the sentence structure and they'll go look up something to make sure they use the right word or whatever, and that will just short circuit your creativity, right? So whenever I sit down in creative mode, I train myself as much as possible, you know, don't go to the editing mode. Now I think it's okay if you're in editing mode and to switch back to creative because you have some great idea and you run with it, but my opinion is never, if you sit down to be in creative mode, let it switch to editing mode.
Yeah, and I mean, my experience has been the same, whether writing, you know, poetry or, you know, short fiction or magazine articles or novels or whatnot. I mean, I think it's just, I'm a firm believer, as Chris just said, of just getting it all out there. And that's sort of the way that I work on my own writing, is just getting it all out there, getting to the end. There's some sweet satisfaction in getting to the end of a piece of work, even though you know you're going to have to go back and do quite a bit of work with it. But it's getting it out there, getting that something to work with, that's really important. And I think one of the things we want to emphasize to the participants in the class.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think you talk about having as a goal for your writers is helping them to know how to find their writing zone and to stay there. And I want to ask you, you know, personally, what does that feel like when you're in that zone? What is it like, whether you're in the creative stage or the editing mm-hmm. stage, what does that zone look like for you? And it might be different.
For me, I think, and for me, being in that zone is sort of the best part of writing, because it's whenever I surprise myself. So when I set out to write something, I have I have sort of a scaffolding. I know sort of where it's starting, where it's going to move to the next piece. But when I have those situations, let's say I have a character walk into a grocery store, and then he turns a corner and something happens that I wasn't expecting. You know, to me, that's when it's the best, when I sort of lose myself as the writer pounding on a keyboard to this character doing something that I didn't know he was going to do when I started my writing that morning.
For me, I'm very much into the psychology of success. And there's a lot of similarities between sports and being successful and writing and being successful and, you know, getting a business off the ground and being successful. And it's practice and it's trial and error and it's learning. But after you do enough of it, those things that you're doing, those activities become second nature, and you can lose yourself in them. And that's what athletes do. They lose themselves. They practice so much that I think most of them would tell you that when they're actually up at bat or they're about to throw the pass or receive the pass, football catch, you know, they're not thinking. They're just doing. And it's because of all those practice sessions that have helped them. So they're in the zone. Same thing with writing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the idea of peer learning and what you can learn from, say, yourself as an editor versus having someone on the outside either do a review or provide you with some constructive criticism. And when is it constructive versus maybe not that helpful?
Great, great subject there. I think one of the things that we do in this class is we have people turn in some work, you know, toward the end. And it's not a lot. They don't have to write, you know, 10,000 words. It's very short. But what we do is we sit down and we do an edit for them. And the reason for that is because you can tell someone, you know, all these tips and techniques, but when they actually see it in action in the edited document, you know, I believe that's when a lot of the light bulbs go on. And it did for me. When I started writing in the beginning for magazines, I was nowhere near as good as I am now. And editors and also friends who are more advanced than me would help. And, you know, to see their thought process in the edited document was just invaluable.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that, you know, sort of having peers review your work helps you quite a bit, helps you grow. I think that for me as a writer, you know, it's probably, my first response when they don't say this is great is that, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. But of course, you know, that usually lasts about 15 seconds. Generally, the things that people say that stick to you, or let's say you're in a group of five people, and if all five people tell you that this character is, let's say, a flat character, or this character is not a sympathetic character, you know, if all five people tell you that, that's probably something, you know, that you need to listen to, and you need to sort of be aware of that. And I think all feedback that you receive, regardless of whether or not you take it initially or not, you know, sort of goes back in the back of your mind. One thing that, it was funny, I was talking to a group of writers the other day, and when my first novel was published about 10 years ago now, my editors at the time had a suggestion. They had a suggestion for the ending of that novel. I didn't take their suggestion. And I certainly, you know, the novel is what it is. But I will say that from that suggestion, which was to give my characters a little bit more hope, I will say that I've taken that piece of advice, that kernel of advice, with every bit of writing that I've done in the last 10 years. Not that, you know, I believe everything has to have a happy ending, but I think that all peer suggestions do sort of work their way into your work and become your sort of writing consciousness, if you will.
And I do have a theory about people critiquing writing. I mean, you do have to be very careful who you show it to, mm-hmm. because a lot of people don't have your best interests in mind when you show them your writing. And family members are notorious for saying, oh, it's great, so it doesn't actually give you feedback that you can use to improve. But on the flip side of that, I mean, I've had so many past participants just talk about their riding and someone just eating it alive, you know, and just giving horrible feedback. And I always say to those people that, you know, no one can tell you whether you're a good rider or not. I mean, that's not their job. You know, you have to decide, can I, you know, how great a rider I can be. But I have a theory that, you know, anybody that just tears somebody's riding up is insecure with their own riding. You know, I don't know if you agree with that, Steve, but I've just seen it happen over and over again. And even some great riders will tear into people. But I think, you know, I think all riders are insecure to a certain extent because you're exposing yourself on the written page.
Yeah, and we obviously want to shoot for constructive criticism. I mean, nobody, certainly in a class that we're leading or none of the classes that I've been a part of, are we looking to tear apart writers. I know that does happen. You know, it sort of goes back to book reviewing. I never quite understand the book reviewers who just tear up a book, you know, who spend 500 words saying how bad a book is. You know, maybe it's sort of germane or whatnot, but I always, you know, I have the opportunity to review books, and if I have a book in front of me that I don't like, you know, I just won't review it. I sort of go with my mother's, you know, if you don't have anything good to say, don't say anything at all. And so I think that, you know, I always at least try to offer some hope to the people in the you know, participants in the class, certainly not suggesting any untruths, but there's got to be some you know, there's some value in what they've written, and I do believe that, and I think that some people just need support. Some people need support to take their writing to the next level instead of being torn down.
And every writer can improve if they try and put the work in. Every writer can improve.
Your mediums overlap in some ways, I'm guessing, but Steve, tell me what it's like to have worked in some of the, let's say, more traditional forms of publishing, you know, putting out a novel or putting out a book of poetry. I think there must be a lot of patience required in that process. And what does that process look like? And how do you kind of maintain that patience and confidence that we've talked about being so crucial to a writer?
You know, most of my books have taken probably about five years or so to sort of come to fruition. You know, some maybe a little bit longer, some maybe in a 3-year range. But one of the things is writing, at least for me, you know, I've been writing now for about 18, 19 years. And you know, whenever people that I'm working with say, are you writing? I always say, am I breathing? And I'm not trying to be smart, but I mean, I'm always writing. It's just sort of who I am. I wake up in the morning and I write. And if I don't write, I don't sort of feel right that day. And I think as far as sort of keeping going, one of the things that helps me is that I do generally work on different projects at the same time. And so that if I work on a book length work for 2 or 3 months and I get sort of tired of it, I get stuck, I need to move on to something else, that work, that constant work that we were talking about, gives me the opportunity to go off in another direction, work on another piece of work for, again, 3-4 months, come back to this other piece, and sort of, you know, go back and forth. You know, so I think, you know, I'm somewhat pigheaded, in the sense that I just sort of bear down and do it. You know, none of us, I think, write with the knowledge that we're going to be published. I mean, I think that writing itself is an act of, optimism. I think that, you know, you have to sort of have, you know, why should you spend an hour there typing when you could spend that hour watching, you know, Orange is the New Black? You know, I mean, you've got to want something from it. You know, you've got to want, it's got to give you something as you're giving it. I mean, why are you doing it? And again, I think that it's the sort of thing that the more you do, the more you need it. And so, you know, we keep plugging away. And I also think that the little successes you have sort of give you just enough to take you to the next, to sort of hold you off and to sort of convince you. And like I mentioned before, that I think that every time you complete a novel or a story or any sort of book, that it gives you the confidence that at least you know that you can complete one, you know, and I think that's it's a pretty good feeling. You know, giving people that support, giving people that push to finish something instead of sort of getting bogged down on those first 10 pages and just editing and editing and editing those 10 pages until you sort of beat the life out of the work or the writing that could be there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think you have to complete things to feel confident, to feel like you can complete the next thing.
regarding what you say, you know, why do you sit down and write versus spend an hour watching TV? You've probably heard a saying that a 20-minute walk in nature will do more for your well-being than 20 years of therapy, right? Well, I feel like writing is the same, that, you know, 20 to 30 minutes of writing every day will help your well-being.
Yeah, and I think even like you, I think if you can sit down and you can commit to writing 20 to 30 minutes a day, I mean, that's a big commitment. It truly is. But again, not to beat up TV or Netflix again, but that's an episode of The League, and if you can sit there and you can write that, I mean, it shows that commitment. It shows that you're willing to do it. And I think there's something, you get something out of that in the end as well, because you've accomplished what you set out to accomplish.
And you can always watch the TV shows on the Stairmaster on your iPad while you're working out.
Exactly. Chris Laney is the author of the blog Lessons from the Cockpit, Everyday Wisdom from the Flying Life. He was joined by Steve Cushman. Cushman's latest chapbook of poetry is titled Hospital Work. Together, the two are co-teaching The Right Motivation, a 6-week creative writing class. The course meets every Monday beginning September 9th and will run through November 3rd at the Creative Writing Center of Greensboro. For more information on Chris Laney and Steve Cushman and for a link to The Right Motivation registration page, visit our website at wfdd.org, and once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Associate producer Bethany Chafin. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Creation, collaboration, and risk define much of Paper Lantern Theater Company and its work. They're celebrating their 7th season, beginning this week in Greensboro with Jeffrey Hatcher's 2010 play Mrs. Mannerly. In 1967 Steubenville, Ohio, Mrs. Mannerly has graduated countless students, but none have ever received a perfect score on the final exam. Her newest student, 10-year-old Jeffrey, is determined to be the first. Paper Lantern actor Stephen Moore is Jeffrey, and Cindy Strickland is Mrs. Mannerly. They're joined by director Brooke Davis.
Manners. Thoughtful manners.
How do you walk that line and bring out the hilarious comedy and then some of the darker or more serious aspects of the play?
You play every bit of it honestly, and I am blessed with these actors who understand that even at the funniest moments, these characters are being honest and clear with one another and looking at each other and saying ludicrous, ridiculous things, but in their world, it makes total sense. So then when we get to about probably 2/3 of the way through the show, there's a bit of a shift of tone and the heart starts to come out, and it's a perfect transition because these actors have not played for gags but have been playing honest people.
What are you doing in rehearsal to make it such that you are more honest in your portrayal?
I think to make it honest in the moment is to certainly just listen. You work out some things in rehearsal as to what you're going for, what you think it means to you. Once you're, and even in rehearsal certainly, but certainly in performance, the way to make it spontaneous right then is to simply listen to the other person.
Absolutely, and let the other person's performance feed yours and inform yours and allow oneself the vulnerability to react in the moment. Learning the lines is just the first step. In many ways, that's the easy part. Master Jeffrey, thank you for your long and wholly unnecessary note.
Hello.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you?
Yes.
Your...
Master Jeffrey Hatcher?
You're welcome.
Oh, you're welcome.
Bravo.
Bravo.
Brava?
What?
Pardon?
Mommy?
Mommy can't help you now.
I'm confused.
Oh, you said what? One should never say what when one hasn't heard what was said or doesn't understand what was said or just needs more time to answer a difficult question. One says, I beg your pardon.
I beg your pardon.
Not at all. As for bravo, bravo, Master Jeffrey, is the masculine form of the Italian for I appreciate you. Brava is the feminine. I say to you, bravo. You say to me, brava.
Brava.
Bravo.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And you owe me a quarter. Any student who says what instead of I beg your pardon has to put a quarter in my jar.
I don't have a quarter.
You can start a tab.
One man on the chessboard. Cindy, comedy all about timing, but I mean, it's a complex role in many ways.
Well, I think in general, oftentimes one of the mistakes folks can make with a comedy that really is this funny, there's a laugh a minute, but oftentimes it's easy to miss the heart and the soul of the characters. And that was one of the things that drew me to this play, made me fall in love with it. Mrs. Mannerly, as hilarious as she is and as hilarious as her students are, it is a play about relationships and friendships, surprising friendships that can develop between teachers and students, between adults and children. It's a fascinating play in that regard, too. Emily tries,
but misunderstands. Paper Lantern Theater Company actors Cindy Strickland and Stephen Moore and director Brooke Davis. Mrs. Mannerly by Jeffrey Hatcher continues at Triad Stages Cabaret Theater in Greensboro through October 5th. Beginning October 8th, the Paper Lantern production comes to Winston-Salem, where it'll run through the 19th with evening shows at 8 and Sunday matinees at 2. You'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Jorge Clifton. You'll find podcasts and photos for all the artists and events featured on the show, as well as archived episodes. They're at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.